From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made, well, how about this? Sometimes someone else has written the story so beautifully that the best course of action is to defer. So let me read from The New Yorker's Nicola Twilley, who wrote the following, quote, "Just over a billion years ago, many millions of galaxies from here, a pair of black holes collided. They had been circling each other for eons in a sort of mating dance, gathering pace with each orbit, hurtling closer and closer. By the time they were a few hundred miles apart, they were whipping around at nearly the speed of light, releasing great shudders of gravitational energy. Space and time became distorted like water at a rolling boil. In the fraction of a second that it took for the black holes to finally merge, they radiated 100 times more energy than all the stars in the universe combined. They formed a new black hole, 62 times as heavy as our sun, almost as wide across as the state of Maine. As it smoothed itself out, assuming the shape of a slightly flattened sphere, the last few quivers of energy escaped, and then space and time became silent again." End quote. And maybe you know where this is going. Our monthly science roundtable looks at the discovery of gravitational waves, how it happened, what's next, what it all means. Because just recently we learned that those gravitational waves from a merged black hole more than a billion light years away finally reached us here on Earth. 100 years ago, by the way, 100 years ago doesn't seem like such a long time in this context, does it? Well, that's when Albert Einstein said he thought gravitational waves were real. He also doubted, at various points, that we'd ever be able to build something that could detect them. It turns out Einstein was right about the first part. Fortunately for us, essentially he was wrong about the second. And my guests can not only help us understand this remarkable discovery, they can describe their own roles in the process. So in studio, let me welcome all here from RIT's Center for Computational Relativity and Gravitation. Our first three guests, Carlos Lusto, who is a professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences and a faculty member in the Astrophysical Sciences and Technology PhD program at RIT. Carlos, nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Richard O'Shaughnessy is here, an assistant professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences and a faculty member in the Astrophysical Sciences and Technology PhD program in the College of Science at RIT. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also here is John Whalen, an associate professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences and a faculty member in the Astrophysical Sciences and Technology PhD program in the College of Science at RIT. It's a mouthful. John, welcome.
Thank you.
And also here is Stephen Penn, an associate professor of physics at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Made the trip up for us. Nice to have you here, Stephen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, I am going to try to do my best to work through what at least I understand. Was the background, was that largely right? The opening, yes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was a little flowery, but yes, correct.
I know, but it's it's a beautiful story here. It's really remarkable to me. We think it's, I've heard, let's see here, a billion years ago, 1.3 billion years ago. How long ago did we think?
Yeah, the precision on that is actually a bit less than, when one says 1.3 billion, right, it's actually about, is that sort of give or take, what, maybe 30% or so?
Okay.
That when you figure out how far away it happened, which is how long ago it happened because the gravitational waves came to us at the speed of light, you also try to figure out, as the black holes spiraled into each other, were we looking at them face on? Were we sort of, looking down the barrel of the orbits? Or were we looking at it edge on, where they just seemed to be moving back and forth? And the more face on it was, the brighter the gravitational waves would have been. And so it's possible that it could have been a little bit farther away and a little more face on, or a little bit closer and a little more edge on. This is actually the thing that Richard works most closely on, the parameter estimation, figuring out what were the properties of the things that we saw.
Okay.
Yeah, so my way in here is remark that distances are very difficult to compute in astronomy. And one of the many important new things that brings this detector is the capability of measuring distances with an accuracy never heard of before. So even if we provide some error in this determination of the distance to this collision of two black holes, this is way more accurate than we are used to in astronomy.
Now, my understanding is Einstein, throughout his lifetime, when he was working through this idea, he kind of went back and forth on, does it exist, does it not? Well, we probably will never be able to find it because how are we going to build something so sensitive to detect it, yes?
There was a debate for 40 years after Einstein produced his first estimates. If this gravitational waves that came up as mathematical solutions of general relativity had a real physical content or not. So it was only until the late 50s that it was established that definitively this carry energy and this will be measurable by future detectors on Earth, as it happened last September.
But we didn't have anything at the time, obviously, that could actually detect a gravitational wave. And we didn't know that we could, in terms of building something of the necessary scale, the money involved that it would take. And there was kind of a false start that happened. And the New Yorker article, which, by the way, I've posted on our Twitter feed, which you really ought to read. I know it's flowery, but it's really beautiful. And it's fun to read because it reads, it's almost like reading The Big Short, Michael Lewis's book, where you go, what exactly happened in the financial collapse? And then you get it in a very digestible story form. Well, the New Yorker's really done that in their long-form article on what happened with the discovery of gravitational waves. So my understanding is, I think in the mid-late 60s, there was kind of a start and stop. There was a gentleman who was pushing to create these discoveries. He announced some discoveries. Some newspapers announced that we had found these things, that we were changing the nature of the way we understood the universe. And it turned out, no, he didn't. And no, is that correct?
You want to speak about Joe Weber's? He had a technology that was quite advanced for the time in the 60s. He was using bars, resonant bars, using developed technology, and he started the field really. But these gravitational waves are way too weak when they get to Earth to be detected by this technology. So the new thing of the 80s with LIGO that introduced a different concept of detector, which is laser interferometry.
All right, so Joe Weber had been sort of on the right track, but some of the early announcements were not correct. That put a little bit of a damper in some ways on the desire to fund it, the hope that we would ever be able to detect gravitational waves. And yet, There was, I think it went in the mid-1970s, the hope for discovery kind of reawakens anew, and all of these conversations start to happen on what do we need to build, what could possibly detect a gravitational wave that's coming from, I don't know, a billion light years away, or wherever it's coming from in the universe. How are we going to detect it, and what do we need to do to build it? And the interesting thing is, after that failure, they had to go to, I think, the National Foundation of Sciences and say, we're going to need hundreds of millions of dollars to build something that may or may not work to detect something we might not be able to actually detect. And by the early 1990s, they finally said, oh, okay, you know, that's amazing to me. Is that oversimplifying, or is that...
So then, Steve is the instrument scientist here, so you can probably speak to the...
We're about to move into the instrument side of it.
So I think in part of that history, you're looking back at Weber's announcement of a detection. Within the sciences, this idea of having to verify one's data is something that we take for granted. And so going through that process of having other groups build other bars and find that they weren't detecting events in coincidence with Weber led us to doubt his announcements. But that's just, for us, a time of reexamination, for us to go back to the drawing board and not to necessarily cast doubts on the theory, but to say maybe we need to look a little bit harder. There are a lot of noise sources. When you are talking about a length displacement of our mirrors that when advanced LIGO reaches its full sensitivity is 1/10,000th of the diameter of a proton, you are talking about a device where almost any possible noise source that you can imagine is going to move the detector more than the gravitational wave.
All right, hold on. So let's back it up, because what Stephen is describing now is the actual device used to measure. I think there are two of them. Is that right? Where are they located?
There are two in the United States.
Okay.
One is in eastern Washington near the Hanford site, and one is in eastern Louisiana. And it's important to recognize, though, that these detectors in the United States do not operate alone. We're in close collaboration with a 3-kilometer detector that is located outside of Pisa in Italy. There's a 600-meter detector in Germany. There is the Kagra detector that is being built in Japan, and just recently announced the government of India is going to be building a detector that's going to be a sister observatory to the LIGO detectors somewhere in India.
But see if you can picture this, listeners, because what Stephen is describing is a process in which if we are going to be able to discern a gravitational wave, we have to be able to make sure it's not something else. It's not a passing truck. It's not a windstorm. All the different things. And there literally, I think, are hundreds, if not thousands, of possible other factors that had to sort of be controlled for. And you have to make sure that it is not those things. That you had to build something really, really sensitive and, frankly, really, really big and really, really complex. And that's some of what Stephen is describing. So take us through that process then. How big are the detectors, Stephen?
The detectors that we have in the United States are 4 kilometer long.
Four kilometer long.
So we have what's called an interferometer. It's a detector that is like an L shape with even-sized arms at 4 kilometers. And then within each arm, you can think of the laser going out from the corner, the vertex, and striking a mirror at the end and coming back. That's actually a simplified version. Our laser light goes out and bounces back many times before it finally recombines. And so those, we are basically sensing the stretching of space-time along those 2 orthogonal directions.
It's really amazing to me. But the actual materials, the mirror, which you worked on the mirror, yes?
That's correct.
The mirror is, I've got a pile of notes here. I love some of the descriptions of the mirrors just because of how
it's about 37 centimeters in diameter, 15 centimeters thick. It's made from ultra-high purity annealed fused silica. That's one of the things I worked on. But the one of the difficult things that we are have faced in building Advanced LIGO and will continue to face in our advancement of this field is the fact that you need to reflect the light off of the surface. When you're talking about detecting small length displacements that are subparticle, the interaction of light with the surface of the mirror actually becomes a very challenging problem to work out. And it's taken us many years, and it remains. There was recently a congressional testimony by our collaboration before the House Subcommittee on Science and Technology. And when asked, what are the difficult technical challenges you face going forward, they took several minutes to talk about the fact that making sensitive mirrors is a difficult and ever more difficult project as we go forward and build more sensitive detectors.
Just reading from the article, at first the mirrors were suspended from loops of steel wire?
That's correct.
Okay. For the upgrade, they were attached instead to a system of pendulums, which insulated them even further from any seismic tremor. So again, keeping that process going of making sure that whatever is detected is not going to be some sort of an outside source. What's the short list of the biggest possible disturbances that would get in the way, Stephen?
There isn't a short list.
What's the most likely culprits out there?
There's a very long list. Seismic disturbances on the low frequency side, it's very difficult for us to go to very low frequencies below 1 hertz just because of the level of seismic disruption that you find in the Earth. In the high end, the big difficulty is what we would call quantum noise. It's noise derived from the laser. And in the middle for Advanced LIGO, it's actually these thin mirror coatings. But there's a lot of other sources of noise. We have a very good team that works on monitoring environmental noises to make sure it's nothing like lightning strikes or acoustic coupling or something like a plane flying overhead. There's a lot of monitoring that goes on to make sure there's no other possible noises.
So the process of building these instruments, it takes place. And then, for lack of a better question, Stephen, when did you know that it was going, that it could work, that it was ready to receive a possible gravitational wave?
Well,
I
detection.
I guess not until September, right, when
right.
it happened?
If the instrument is going to respond at the sensitivity of our design research, we were fairly confident that we were going to see something somewhere in Advanced LIGO's history. I don't know if my colleagues have other feelings, but I didn't expect it coming this soon. I was expecting more after we had done a few more observing runs, because we still have about a factor 3 sensitivity that we can still gain before we hit design sensitivity with Advanced LIGO. So that's a factor 3 more in sensitivity, factor 3 more in distance, a factor 27 more in volume. So a factor 27 more in possible event rate.
You can do better here.
We can do better, even with this instrument.
Yeah, the event happened actually while it was in the final stages of engineering testing and running. It was supposed to be almost as good as an actual science run, but it was just the final days of testing.
Which is this past September.
September 14th.
September 14th here. Because when you say it happened so soon here, I mean, this thing was barely online, right? That's what Carlos is talking about.
It was four days,
4 days
before our observing run was supposed to start.
Okay. And so before I then back up and bring in sort of the RIT connection on all of the work that laid the groundwork for this discovery, I want to ask Stephen here, given Joe Weber's history, given the history of trying to detect gravitational waves and the starts and stops and sort of the false alarms, I suspect you and your colleagues are very careful to make sure that this is not another false alarm. Fair?
Well, September 14th to February 11th is almost 6 months of being careful.
September 14th is when the detection of the wave happened.
That's correct. I mean, we want to be very, very careful, and for good reason. The public has put our trust in us to the tune of $1 billion, and we want to be extremely careful to honor ourselves and our hard work, to honor the public for supporting us, to honor the National Science Foundation for sticking with us. It's important to get your science right.
And the signal appeared in two independent detectors. That was one important difference, that we could cross-check any event with the equivalent in an independent detector.
So I think we actually have a one-second audio file of what the wave kind of sounds like. So John Andrews, let's listen to that. What are we hearing there, Steve? I guess we're hearing the wave.
Yeah, this is a chirp signal. I should actually turn over a little bit to my RIT colleagues because they're the ones who work on the templates for determining what this wave is going to look like for particular astronomical sources.
Let's listen one more time. Almost sounds fake. It's a gravitational wave. And so if you're just joining us, it's our monthly science roundtable, and we're talking about the detection of gravitational waves, which happened back in September. But as Steve just said, there was a patient process of working through the data and keeping it under wraps, and now the world gets to find out about what's been going on here, that Einstein's ideas are sort of bearing fruit here 100 years later, that we are detecting a gravitational wave that came from, they think, more than 1 billion light years away when two black holes merged and sent out these ripples of energy and of gravitational energy. Is that the right term, John Whalen?
Gravitational radiation.
Okay.
That's the word we usually use.
Okay. I'm not flunking so far. So far, we're hanging in there. I do find this so endlessly fascinating. And so our guests here are talking about not only what happened, but their roles in it. And RIT had a central role here. We go back, what is it, I think 2004, 5? When did this all happen?
The center started operating here in RIT in 2007. So a group actually of researchers that were working in Texas had produced these supercomputer predictions and then moved to RIT in 2007. I wanted to mention that the results of gravitational waves is one of the main results. So I consider equally important the fact that these gravitational waves come from the collision of binary black holes. So we get actually two confirmations of general relativity, Einstein theory. One is the prediction of gravitational waves that deal with fast oscillations of the gravitational field that we haven't been able to measure before. And the second important, equally important results is the existence of black holes that can collide and produce those gravitational waves. And black holes are representative of what happens with the gravitational field becomes so strong that not even light can escape from that. So we tested two unseen features of the general theory of gravitation, fast oscillations of the field, gravitational waves, strong field regime, black holes.
Okay, you're hearing Carlos Lusto and his colleagues Richard O'Shaughnessy and John Whalen are here from RIT's Center for Computational Relativity and Gravitation. So the dumbed down explanation I keep giving to people is you know, RIT and the people who are in the studio now come in and they basically put together a model that says, if this exists and it's coming our way, this is what it's going to be like. Is that essentially right, John, Richard?
So we actually contribute in several areas to the LSE at RIT. Richard and I have worked in gravitational wave data analysis for a number of years.
What data did you have to analyze?
We had all the data from initial LIGO, right? So this advanced LIGO that just went online is the sort of second generation of this instrument.
Okay.
And when they proposed this in the 90s, they said, okay, look, to get to the sensitivity we want to be able to have a very strong chance of detecting gravitational waves, we need to get there in stages. And so the first stage was initial LIGO that ran from 2002 to 2010, I believe. And that sort of got more and more sensitive. But by the end of its run, it was only a tenth as sensitive as advanced LIGO was going to be, and so about a third as sensitive as it is now. And that's actually why, you know, even though we operated advanced LIGO for several years, even if this thing, which was a fairly loud gravitational wave, had happened back then, we wouldn't have seen it, because we could only see maybe a third as far by the end of advanced LIGO. By the end of initial LIGO.
Okay. And Richard, tell me a little bit about the role you and the team played here then as this moved forward.
I guess you could say we do two things. One is we figure out what we expect to see. And two is we compare the data with what we expect to see if we found it.
Okay. Simple as that.
Yep.
And you never know when it's going to come through. But when it came through in September, it looked and what's the right term? Looked, sounded, it was detected in the same. It was what you thought it would be?
It was exactly what we thought.
Was it really?
Yes. It was shocking.
Everyone's jaw hit the floor because they looked at the data and they said, this can't be right. Someone must be faking it.
We were very fortunate that this was so loud because normally we shouldn't be able to just look at the time series and see, oh, look, there's the wave. But in fact, this time, this was such a strong signal. You know, again, relative to the very reduced noise that advanced LIGO has compared to before, that we could actually even see this in the data.
And for just a little bit of a historical comparison, you know, I've made this comparison before, but I think it's apt. You can go back to, I think, 300 BC, and Epicurus was talking about atoms. Now, obviously, they didn't have the instruments to detect atoms, but Epicurus was writing and talking at the time, saying that the world was probably composed of tiny pieces of matter in some way, and that eventually maybe we'd ever see them. And some people probably thought that's crazy, and some people thought, well, that would be interesting, but we'll probably never have something sensitive enough to see it. Well, obviously Epicurus was right. It took a long time to get there, and that's why I just think what they were doing is so interesting. You know, Richard was laughing. I said, did it turn out to be what you thought it was? And you said it was exactly what we thought it would be, which is this amazing thing, because you are creating this model, this idea that doesn't yet exist or that we know of, we don't have evidence of it, and it turns out it arrives in September, and there it is. And I kind of want to ask you about that moment, because you all kept it under wraps pretty successfully for a little while here. But according to the New Yorker story, you know, it was, let's see here, it was Marco Drago, a 32-year-old Italian postdoctoral student and a member of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, who was the first person to notice on that September day, and he was sitting in front of his computer at the Albert Einstein Institute in Hanover, Germany, viewing the LIGO data remotely. The waves appeared on his screen as a compressed squiggle, but the most exquisite ears in the universe, attuned to vibrations of less than a trillionth of an inch, would have heard what astronomers call a chirp, what we've been listening to. John, play it again, if we can. Let's, I guess you'd hear something like this. He's going to, just a second here. There it is, a faint whooping from low to high. And then, I guess, the word starts to spread. Rainer Weiss, is that the right name, gentlemen?
We usually call him Ray, but yeah.
Okay, Ray Weiss, now 83 years old, the physicist who was the one who pushing ahead with LIGO back in 1972. He was on vacation in Maine, logged onto his computer, saw the signal, heard the news, and yelled, "My God," loudly enough that his wife and adult son came running, thought something was wrong. How did you guys, I want to know how you all found out, and I kind of want to go around the room. Carlos, how did you find out?
Yeah, first of all, I was speechless then.
Did you find out that day? I mean, did everybody sort of spread it around? Did they call you?
What happened? Immediately this spread in the whole community of scientists involved.
I think Marco's email went to the entire collaboration, in fact. So as PI of the RIT group, I said, oh, we better write to everybody in the group and say, hey, by the way, don't talk to anyone outside the LSE about this yet.
Disbelief, because it was almost too good to be true, too perfect. In fact, binary black holes are perfect mathematical machines. They're one of the few objects that we can describe very accurately, very mathematical, very clean system as they happen in the universe. So we had this very accurate prediction of how they collide and what they produce and what we should have observed. And when you see this, that nature realized this, you can still not believe it. So it took a couple of weeks to convince myself and many of our colleagues. And as Stephen said, it was 5 months of very detailed review, trying to see things, cross-check, seeing from different angles, make sure that it wasn't nothing else but the signal of the collision of these two black holes.
Richard, that day when you found out, were you also thinking that would be remarkable, but what if it's not? I mean, what was going through your mind?
I was very happy because this is sort of comparisons are my bread and butter. Some colleagues and I had gone out on a limb and said that we should probably see something very soon. Although I didn't quite bet someone. I was going to talk to Stephen Ballmer and bet him, you know, maybe we'll detect something during an engineering run. I should have taken that bet.
Why did you think we should see something very soon? Explain that.
So the universe, LIGO is an extremely conservative plan to detect things that we know are out there. We have seen what's left over after massive stars explode, some black holes and some neutron stars. And we've seen pairs of neutron stars because occasionally they rotate rapidly and emit pulses, which we call pulsars. And we've seen them orbit around each other. In fact, there was a Nobel Prize awarded for discovering a pair of them orbit around each other. And we know that they're going to gradually get closer and closer together until eventually they coalesce. And we can just count up how many there are and say, oh, well, if LIGO, you make LIGO this sensitive, then it's going to start finding them. So we knew that LIGO would detect those. But LIGO is more sensitive to things that are bigger, up to a certain mass scale. And we have good reason to believe that there are a lot of black holes throughout the universe. And it turns out, there are a lot of black holes.
Some in the media have been writing about this, like, this was the one chance to get to find that signal, and good thing we got it up on time because we barely made it right in the window and we got it. You know, we're going to see more of this, right?
Oh, this is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
This is 16 days out of the first few months. And then, as Steve said, LIGO is just going to get more sensitive. We're going to discover tens, then hundreds, then maybe thousands of these things over the lifetime of LIGO's operation. And that's just these things. This is just opening a new window on the universe where we're seeing the first thing that's creeping through the door. That's a terrible metaphor. first piercing light that strikes us in the eye as we look out onto the wonderful fields full of new discoveries. But there's a lot of other things that'll be creeping up on us as well.
Okay. John Whalen, what was your reaction?
Can I just interject?
Yeah.
Everyone at this table, all the scientists here, spent a number of years of our careers as postdocs. And so I'd like to point out postdoctoral researchers are not students. This is one thing that the New Yorker misstated when they referred to him as a postdoctoral student. He's a postdoctoral researcher. Right. So I have to say that I recall one of my first thoughts being that must be an injection. Because we had a fairly strong signal as part of the last science run of initial LIGO, and we knew that there was what was called a blind injection challenge going on, where there could be a signal inserted into the data. We do injections all the time, right? So all the times we add simulated signals to the data and verify that
this is like a police dog, and you put a bag of drugs in a locker to make sure the dog can still find it.
Yeah, and you do that as a test, and sometimes you tell the dog it's there, and sometimes you don't.
Sure, but it doesn't mean that's the real thing, right?
And so certainly when this happened in initial LIGO, since we didn't expect to see something that strong, that gave us a good hint that it was probably an injection. And so in this case, I think that the real sort of amazement came when we found out that it wasn't a blind injection, when people said, no, there wasn't a blind injection going on at the time. This was a real signal. And I actually remember seeing the details of it maybe a couple of days later. I was in Richard's office, and he had some plots from the data. And there were, like I said, there was this time series plot. Normally, we have to use sophisticated signal processing, match filtering techniques to pull out the signals. So normally, we shouldn't be able to just point at the data. And so the fact that I could, that you could just see by eye, in time, the waves going up and down, that was remarkable. And I think I said, this can't be right. This can't be real. This looks too good. But the other interesting thing was that these things were also more massive than we thought they were going to be. I remember when we were doing the initial LIGO, the first search for in-spiral merger and ring down there, in the paper we had to justify, why are we even looking for black holes that are more than 20 times the mass of the sun? Because if you look at the X-ray observations that have shown the various observations we have of black holes in the galaxy, they're usually between 5 and 10 times the mass of the sun, some up to 20, maybe going towards 30. And so the fact that we had two black holes that were about 30 times the mass of the sun, so basically more massive than anything we'd seen with X-ray telescopes, and then that they merged with each other, and then, of course, made an even more massive black hole, that these were things we didn't know for sure. So we certainly didn't know for sure that they existed in a big enough population to be merging for us to see.
John's point, by the way, is well taken on postdoc researchers, not students. Two of the really interesting and potentially biggest science stories, I don't know, of a year, of a decade, have been fueled by postdoc researchers. In this case, at least you had Mr. Drago, postdoc researcher, not a student.
Dr. Drago.
Thank you, John. Dr. Drago, and then down at Yale, Dr. Tabitha Boyajian and her team have been working on this fascinating star that's about 1,500 light years away, that there's some speculation that maybe that's a Dyson swarm around the star, and we'll do a whole other show on that. But if you want to have some fun, Google the term Dyson swarm, and then you'll go down another rabbit hole. But that's for another science roundtable. Anyway, I want to ask Steve, what was your reaction? When did you know this was real, and what did you think?
That afternoon, I mean, emails were just flying through the collaboration. And the thing that really sparked my interest was the fact that this was happening before the observing run started, which meant that it was happening before a time when one would expect there to be a blind ejection. So as John referred, we went through this previous event that was a blind injection. And, you do a little bit of social science, right? You think, what's the probability that someone would have done a blind injection? during the last one, because it was right at the end of the run, a lot of us, when we saw that event, thought, that's a likelihood that that's probably a blind injection. And this time, that seemed very unlikely. The other thing that I thought was interesting was that, in the arguments to fund advanced LIGO, there was a lot of signals that were calculated, and having these large tens of masses of black holes in spiraling was one of the ones that was used as a case that we would like to see. And the fact that we got something that was close to a previous calculation, I thought was interesting, and I'm glad this turned out to be a real event, because it showed that the foresight that went into predicting the events we would like to see was well justified.
I'm late for a break, but I also just want to ask you, everyone in this room thinks so scientifically. I mean, just if you're not a scientist, we all think emotionally, which is why John had a little fun with the opening being a little flowery, but it was. But Stephen, was there a moment where you kind of catch your breath and say, everything that we've been working toward was just confirmed in a moment?
Yeah. I mean, there was just a sort of sense of relief that you felt passed through me, and I could sort of sense it in my colleagues as well. We've been working for many, many years on building the apparatus, and then you think about the people who've come before us and the people working around the world who've been trying to develop this field, and now suddenly we can all sort of let out our breath. And the visions that we have for things going forward, the next generation of detectors, a possible detector in space, all these things that were hopes now become real chances.
This is going to be the lamest question of the hour, but forgive it. Have any of you thought what Einstein would think about this moment?
He would think it's wonderful. He would think it's fantastic, I think. Yeah.
Does that ever cross your mind, John?
So, and we have thought about you know, how is it, so there's a statement that Einstein wouldn't have predicted or didn't think this was going to be detectable, right? Because he didn't know that we would be able to build something as sensitive as LIGO, and he also didn't know that there were astrophysical black holes. So I think the answer to that depends on whether Einstein has been also receiving messages about all the other discoveries in astrophysics in the last 50 years or so.
Yeah. Carlos?
I agree with John. It's very difficult to translate these 100 years of increased knowledge. And also how science works. We were speaking about this 40 years for scientific discussions to convince ourselves that gravitational waves carry energy. Also, it took us 40 years to solve the collision of black holes to work on supercomputers. So it is a building process. Also, it is worth mentioning the National Science Foundation supporting this LIGO detector for 25 years, another billion dollars invested in this experiment.
When were atoms discovered, by the way? When did we actually discover atoms? It was in the 1800s somewhere, in the 19th century, I think.
Wasn't it Rutherford? Yeah. I know, this is all like, this is like basic science.
It depends. Right, it depends if you're talking about like the isolation of elements in the periodic table. Do they then know that there's a fundamentals? Because one could argue, once you know that there's a periodic table, then you know there's some fundamental that is represented by each of these elements.
As we go to break, here's why I ask. About 2,000 years roughly maybe between Epicurus saying, maybe atoms are out there, maybe we'll get them eventually. 2,000 years for that. 100 years between Einstein and September on a gravitational wave, thanks at least in part to the work of the people in this room, makes you just shudder to think of what is next. And we're going to talk about that after this short break as we continue on our monthly science roundtable, the detection and verification of a gravitational wave, the amazing story, and all that's wrapped up in it. Short break and more of that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, it's a reporter's roundtable in our first hour talking about how we cover scandal. What are the rules for what can be covered and what should not be? What's inbounds and what's out? And did it all change in 1987 and 1988 with a Gary Hart affair? Then, second hour, former University of Rochester student Kevin Connell joins us talking about the cost of higher ed. Talk with you Tuesday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Sweden has taken in more migrants per capita than any other European country, and tens of thousands of these are unaccompanied minors.
They want to start school immediately, they want to work, they want to do something.
We meet the people helping to settle kids into their new lives. That story and the news out of an emergency EU summit with Turkey later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Email from a listener named Mark who said, Evan, I looked up a Dyson swarm. Are you saying it's aliens? No, I'm not saying it's aliens. I knew I put myself in trouble there. It's probably not aliens with the most interesting star in the galaxy, but the cool thing is we don't know that it's not. It probably isn't. There's always an explanation. In this case, we're pretty certain it's a gravitational wave that was detected by LIGO and the work of many, many people involved, not the least of which are the people in this room. Carlos Lusto, Richard O'Shaughnessy, John Whalen from RIT Center for Computational Relativity and Gravitation, and Stephen Penn, an associate professor of physics at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And let me start working through some listener questions. This is William in Rochester. Go ahead, William.
Yeah, good afternoon. Like your program, Evan.
Thanks.
How efficient will this new technology or this new gravity telescope be in aiding to exactly place the location of this new planet that was the big buzz, you know, a couple of months ago? You know, Planet X, the ninth planet, the tenth planet, whatever.
I see.
I mean, will they be able to use it to actually detect that planet so that they can say for certain, yeah, it's there, and give all the stats on it, cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
William, thanks for the phone call. It's a great question. And let me just have context for the audience if you missed that. This whole Planet X or ninth planet is way, way beyond Pluto, and they think that they know it's there. They think it's probably a very big planet way out there. We haven't been able to observe it yet because it is way out there. It is in our solar system, but it is big, and they think it's there because of the way it's interacting with other bodies, sort of kind of nearby enough that they think it's probably there, but they don't know yet. And his question is LIGO going to help us determine that it's there? I'm seeing a lot of no's around the room.
No.
Not related.
No, because even if theoretically this planet orbiting around the sun emits gravitational waves, they are way too weak and way different frequency than we can detect in with LIGO. What I wanted to come back is to the Vanier black hole collisions. And frequently it is mentioned that this collision is the most energetic event in the universe.
Two black holes colliding?
These two black holes that we observe collide convert in the blink of an eye, 0.2 seconds, twice the mass of the sun into gravitational waves. So the paradox is, how come that this very bright event, the brightest event in the universe, takes us so much effort in detecting here on Earth, right? The problem is that we are not dealing with electromagnetic radiation here. Radio, visible light, X-rays are all electromagnetic radiation. We have very sensitive detectors for those. But gravitational waves actually make oscillate the fabric of the space-time. So it is very stiff and very hard to make it oscillate. So you need very large masses and very concentrated, like in black holes. And even if the release of energy is the largest we ever detected, we need these extremely sensitive detectors like LIGO to actually see them.
Our listener, one of our listeners named Jake, just writes that the article we've been referring to in The New Yorker may have been flowery, but the event was mind-numbingly violent. And he said it released in 50 milliseconds, three times the amount of energy in our entire solar system. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly the computation, but...
Yeah, the three times the mass of the sun it was in the history of the binary black hole, converted from mass into energy.
Wow. It's 50 times the total electromagnetic radiated energy of the universe.
Yeah. Okay. But
the interesting thing is that when that wave passes through our detector, the total energy deposited in our detectors is only about as much as one X-ray photon.
That's so what's left when it gets here.
And it's moving, and we are detecting its motion of mirror masses that are about 80 pounds. So it's moving these very, very, very large masses, and the energy is extremely small.
I think of it as if somebody dropped a rock in a lake in the Mediterranean, in your creek, in your backyard in Hamelin,
it's measuring the distance to the nearest star to the accuracy of one atom, or one hair, sorry.
But go ahead, John.
I was going to say, it's not that the energy is gone by the time it gets to us, it's just that most of the energy just goes right through us, is that we only manage to collect a tiny, tiny fraction of it.
Okay, yes. And here's my super ignorant question that I've not been able to suss out in any of my readings, but that is this. When we find out that September 14th, LIGO gets this hit, this detection of this merging of black holes, my question that I still don't fully understand is, was that the one wave coming our way from that event and that was our one chance to get it? Or did that event generate multiple gravitational waves and we could, I don't know.
From that event, that was the one.
That was the one.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it. That's all we got, one. So, but that's also why Richard said, get ready for a lot more.
Oh, yes. It's just the beginning. I mean, if you count up all of the sources like this, we expect gravitational waves from similar events are going through us about once every 15 minutes. Just some of them are too faint for us to see right now. But as our sensitivity improves, we'll find more and more of those, quite a bit more.
Okay, so help us as we get ready to wrap the hour here, and it is going quickly. Help us push ahead in two different ways. First of all, you know, we know this matters because it's really, really amazing, but why it matters in terms of application going forward, and then what we can expect next year, what the kind of work that's happening as we get, I guess, more and more able to detect in kind of finer ways. So let me just ask in briefly, Carlos, why does this matter?
Well, first, it is a historical event because it really opens, it's a revolution for astronomy. It opens a new window into the universe. We've seen the birth of gravitational wave astronomy, a new branch in astronomy that will allow us to learn about the universe like we never seen it before. So from the science and knowledge point of view, this is very important. But also technologically, we have develop and push the frontiers of our technology to detect these gravitational waves. Measurements of this precision have never been reached before. So we give, for example, the GPS that now we all use for driving in the city or using in our telephones. The fact that we are able to accurately pinpoint our positions within 1 meter of error is because they take into account corrections due to general relativity. We would fail to find the right house or address if we just would use Newtonian theory or neglect general relativity. Likewise, for this detector, you had to develop some of the examples. You had to develop very stable insulation systems from earthquakes, as Stephen was mentioning. And this may have applications for microchips technology, making these nano chips even smaller and more efficient. Then the management of squeeze light, a way of working with light that had no applications before that we are kind of mastering and may have a future like this. There are many things that we do not foresee, as Einstein could not foresee, that his theory would allow us to reach to the right locations in the city while we drive.
And Tom Batley, who's listening from NewYorkPhotonics.org, he says on Twitter, please take note for the Rochester community that you are talking about photonics science. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. We're talking about photonics. I mean, we had to develop the world's most stable lasers in order to make this work. The world's largest vacuum system, the world's lowest noise mirrors. There was lots of advances in optics, seismic isolation, lasers that made this process possible.
All right. And now that you know that you've done this successfully, what happens next here? Whether it's with LIGO or related fields. I'll kind of go around the table. Stephen, go ahead.
Well, next year we're going to continue to push down the noise levels within LIGO. But in the very near future, we're looking forward to the advanced stage of the Virgo detector in Italy coming online. That's going to help us a lot in pinpointing the location of our next signals. A few years after that, we can look forward to the Japanese detector Kagra, and then in the 20s, the India detector. And hopefully, we will see gravitational wave detectors in space. Also, the LISA project, we're very hopeful that now that we've made this discovery, that the LISA project is going to get funded, and we'll see gravity wave detectors in space.
Congress has not funded LISA yet, right?
Currently, LISA is being funded by the European Space Agency, and they now
That didn't sound like Congress.
It doesn't.
Okay.
Right.
That could change.
There was past NASA support.
Okay.
And we're hoping that there will be future NASA support, that they'll work with the ESA in pushing forward LISA.
All right, John, what are you looking forward to going forward now?
Well, so as people have mentioned, there was a source that we expected to see eventually, which is binary neutron stars. And I think we still very strongly expect that as the sensitivity of LIGO improves, we'll get to the range where binary neutron stars will be merging often enough at the distance we can see them to detect them. Towards the end of it, or as LIGO gets to its design sensitivity, there are other sources that we have interest in and we think we have a decent chance of seeing For example, spinning neutron stars. So you have a neutron star that has a little lump on it, spins around very fast. That will also give off gravitational waves. They'll be a lot weaker than from a colossal thing like a black hole collision, but they'll be on for a long time. And so if you add up the signal over a very long period of time, then you can try to detect those.
Okay. Richard?
Well, I'm really excited that we're opening an entirely new window on the universe, and I want to see what we find. We already found lots of black holes, and for those of us who'd like to think about how in the world we made such things, they tell us they open a new window on a population of objects that form from the lives and deaths of massive stars that we'd never seen before. Second, to follow up on Steve's comment, having even one more detector allows us to triangulate on the sky. And since we can identify these things, you know, one moment almost instantaneously, as you referred to with, in the story about Marco, we can then tell all our friends with telescopes, go look over there. And then possibly they can see a big flash, possibly a neutron star getting torn up, or maybe something even more exotic that we haven't imagined yet. And I think that prospect of working together with the rest of astronomy is incredibly exciting.
Well, we have such a program now, but it's now go look in one of these places somewhere in the sky.
And this is an appropriate question to help finish. Emma just writes to us and says, just wants to know, if since the detection of the gravitational wave last September, has it found anything else? Is it offline? Is it back online?
So LIGO is just ended its science run, the observing run, recently. But the results that have been reported are from only the first third of that run, basically. So everything from
Sit here today, do you want to break any news? Is there anything else that you haven't told us?
So as we mentioned, there's a great care taken.
You can't tell,
we can't tell you anything.
Yeah, I mean, all of this careful internal checking, you know, the 6 month that we spent to report the first part of the data, all that careful internal checking is being done with the results of the latter part of the data as well.
Sure. It's a first rule about LIGO Club.
What I would tell you is that we will be very busy. And I know me and my colleagues have slept very little in the last 6 months. And probably we won't be able to catch up anytime soon.
Thank you all for explaining this remarkable discovery and your roles in it. From RIT, Carlos Lusto, Richard O'Shaughnessy, John Whalen, thanks for being here. Thank you to all of you. And Stephen Penn from Hobart and William Smith Colleges. I suspect we'll have more to talk about as the months and years go on with this really amazing stuff. Thank you.
We'll be happy to come back.
We'll be thrilled to have you. Thanks for listening today. John Andrus, the engineer of the broadcast, and Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk with you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.